podcasting. My name is Mariah Rose Wimmer. I'm podcasting this particular podcast, which is called Laser Graves.
Wow. Good job. I am the other co-host, E.K. Wimmer. And I'm so thankful that you introduced us this week.
Yep. Hey, what was it that I wanted our podcast to be called?
Unicorn somethings.
Rainbow shoulder pads?
Oh, unicorn shoulder pads.
Oh, well,
was that what it was?
Something like that.
We'd have to go way back into the archives for that one.
That's too much work. Nope.
Yeah, I have no interest in that.
Something about shoulder pads.
But that's not the name of our podcast.
No.
So this week is going to be an interesting one to get through because our bread and butter is dumb stuff we can make fun of. And we both got the bright idea to do a really cool art house film. And then I think we both kind of had a panic between like halfway through the movie of like, how are we going to get through this? But I think we'll do it. We've done serious episodes before. We're just, I don't think we're in the right mindset. And we'll do a good job.
Speak for yourself. I feel extremely intellectual right now.
Okay. Well, you do have that weird cravat and like a pipe sitting on a stand. So
exactly.
You look like pretty serious right now.
Ready to go.
Except what nobody can see is that the pipe is a pipe-shaped vape machine.
Oh.
Is it called a machine? Oh, wow. I'm totally like...
Why don't they...
so uncool.
Question. Why don't they call them vaporizers?
Why don't they call it vaporizers? Do you remember that movie, Envy, with Ben Stiller and Christopher Walken?
Don't hassle me about crumbs, man.
Crumbs, man. Don't hassle me about the crumbs. That's a good one. All right. Well, that's not the movie we're talking about.
Nope,
not even the right decade.
Totally off.
This week we are talking about Videodrome by David Cronenberg.
Do you wish that it were called Videodrone and not Drome?
No, I've never really thought about it. I've just accepted it as that because that's what I've known it is my whole life.
Okay.
Well, it's an interesting one. This tape did not come to me in the wild. This came as a trade with a fellow collector.
In the wild. Every time you say that, I sincerely imagine, like, people on a safari in Africa and, like, finding, you know, brushing some, you know, sagebrush or whatever native plants there are out there in the desert.
Sagebrush is native to our area.
Maybe it's everywhere. Whatever. Okay. What? It's my imagination. I can put whatever plant I want there. Okay.
Southwestern native plants.
In Africa. Yep, and a zebra trots by, and then you grab some weird VHS tape out of the earth, or pluck it from a tree like an apple, and dust it off, and pop it in like a khaki shoulder bag.
It's close to what I imagine when I say in the wild.
What do you...
I also go with the Africa kind of notion, but instead, mine's like a wild wildebeest of some sort with a VHS tape tied around its neck running past me.
Oh.
And it's like I'm in the middle of talking to a local, and then I see it, and I'm like, hold on! And then I just take off running after it, trying to catch it. The other one that I always imagine is that quintessential...
Ace Ventura!
It's the curiosity monkey that is like... goes and steals things, and you're like, hey, monkey, give that back to me. And it's like, ooh, ah, and runs off with it. And it's the... the monkey that causes the mischief. Mm-hmm. I imagine that there's like, I walk into a thrift store and then I spot this amazing tape and then a monkey grabs it and starts running around the thrift store, like hiding it from me, and I have to chase it. That's finding it in the wild.
Wow. It's much less interesting than that. And also when I shouted Ace Ventura, I imagined the rhino birthing scene.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like
but with
that
VHS.
Too.
Okay.
Okay, well, that was to just say I did not find this. A zebra did
being
not...
being birthed in a rhino?
Yeah, a zebra did not trot past me with it in its mouth.
Okay.
But boring. I did get it in a trade, and I was very happy because it's the original version. It's a really nice copy, and it's a movie, one of the only Cronenberg films both of us have never seen, because we're a big fan of his, and somehow this is just one of those ones that we never got around to. I mean, he's got a lot of films, so that... to our credit, but
yeah,
it it was one that I knew once I got it that we would definitely do it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what we were really in for because his films range so far in tone. And this one was more classic Cronenberg, like what I would expect. Yeah. But speaking of thrift stores...
Oh.
Because this is... If I found this one at a thrift store, I would be jazzed. And lately, I have not been finding much of anything because the collection has gotten really good, which means that I don't just go and go, oh, wow, I don't have that and buy it. The odds of me finding tapes now are so slim that... It leaves me empty-handed a lot, and I'm like, dang it. And so we had gone to a couple thrift stores this week, and I had found nothing. But today...
This very day,
I pulled up to a thrift store that used to kind of have good finds and just hasn't lately. And I, this is nerd alert, I sincerely, as I was getting out of the car, told myself, please just let there be something cool in there for once, because it has just been so dry in that thrift store. And I walked in, and I found one right away, which was Blow Up, that 1960s like art house film. Mm-hmm. I was jazzed about that, because I really like that film a lot. It's kind of a staple in film study school, mm-hmm. and I've been looking for it.
That's the one with the mime scene at the end, right?
Yeah. He's a photographer. He thinks he sees a crime.
I remember the whole story, but it's like the mime scene at the end. Is that Blow Up, or is there a totally different movie?
No, I'm pretty damn sure that's Blow Up. Okay. If not, then I'm getting two very similar films confused.
I haven't seen Blow Up in like a decade.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it in about a decade either. But I was happy to find that, but that wasn't the big one. The big one was I kept looking through, and then I noticed, which will be timely for... not this episode. It was last week's episode. It wasn't last week's episode.
Next week's. This week's. Yesteryear's.
We recorded a couple episodes in a row, and I can't remember now, but I'm going to say it was last week's, and then maybe I'm wrong. I saw the Vestron logo on the side of the tape.
Oh.
What did we do last week?
I don't know, dude. What did I do today?
Oh, we did After the Fall of New York, and that was a Vestron release.
Oh, right.
So I noticed the V logo, and I was like, what? And then I looked, and I pulled the cover, and it was this super rare, totally amazing cover art for a horror, 1981 horror called Don't Go in the Woods. And I was so happy, because this was the find. Did you find anything this week in a thrift store?
Okay.
Well, I'm always excited to hear what you found. Mine are just tapes. Yours are always, like, good finds.
I found a banana costume.
That's right. You wore it, and we will put it on social media, because I forgot I took a photo of you wearing a banana costume.
Yeah, and then both of our daughters thought it was for them. It's not. It's mine.
It's true.
And it's not for Halloween, because guess what? I already bought a Halloween costume.
Yeah, no.
I'm going as Miss Frizzle.
From Magic School Bus?
Yeah.
Cool. That's a good one. That'll be fun. We need to do like a Halloween party, though. Otherwise, it's pointless to wear costumes.
You know, no, because I'm going to trick-or-treat with the girls. But I was really torn between Miss Frizzle and Daphne. I ordered Miss Frizzle. And then the very next day, I saw a what's their bus called? Mystery Machine. For a dog, a Mystery Machine dog costume. And I was like, what?
Oh, man, that would have been amazing.
Me, Daphne, and then Chujin, the dog, as the Mystery Machine.
Hey, do you want to know a little fun fact?
Yeah.
When I was buying that banana costume for you today at the checkout, because today was a really good day. I also found The Omen Part 1 on book. Like a book novelization of it. And I found Bob Marley record. Today clicked. But as I was checking out, the lady said, oh, your daughters are going to enjoy that costume, huh?
And I said,
oh, they're going to go bananas.
Did you say as you left, well, time to split?
No, I just yelled dad joke and gave myself a high five.
Oh,
no, I didn't.
I find it appealing that you made a dad joke.
Yeah, but I don't want to slip up on another joke, so. Do you have anything interesting you want to tell me about yourself this week?
Anything interesting about myself that you... Can you already know it?
Sure. I could already know it. Maybe I already forgot it.
Oh. Okay.
Let's see. Let's test.
All right. Let's see. I'm going to pull it out of my hat. On your marks. Get set. Okay. When I was about 12, I would go visit my friends who lived on a ranch in Montana, and I'd stay with them, and we'd go out into the field. I think they had to collect chicken eggs or something. I don't know. But afterwards, we would grab dried cow pies, like Frisbees, and fling them at each other.
That's pretty cool.
And so we just pelt each other with dried poop, and then we'd float in the river back to their house. So we'd get all the poop washed off of us by the time we got there.
That is exactly what I would imagine kids in Montana to do when they're bored. That is like, I could not come up with a better scenario.
The most hick this is like,
it's so hick. Yeah. Good job.
I know, it's great because I had moved from St. Paul, Minneapolis to Montana, and that was my transition. It was like,
oh, so you went from like people on the street flinging poop at you to you flinging poop at your friends.
Oh, if only. No, nobody flung poop at me.
Oh, that's too bad.
No, sorry.
Well, you got a lot of life to live still, so don't give up hope.
Please, I don't aspire to have any more poop flung at me.
You know what I did when I was little? I was younger than 12, but it would have been not much, maybe 10 or so. I went through this phase where I was obsessed with Goonies. Not that that's gone away, but no. Goonies is top 3 all-time favorite film for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I went through a phase where I would wake up super early and go downstairs before my parents. Like, well, my dad had already gone to work, but my mom would be wherever she was. Well, I don't. Who knows what my mom did in the mornings? But I would run downstairs and I would pop the Goonies in the VCR and try and get through the movie before school.
Aww.
And I would try. I would like almost daily. I would do that.
That's
and
really
just
cute.
Watch it because it got me so excited and adventurous and stuff.
Oh, so you had to, like, pregame adventure before school?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's darling.
So, yeah. Anyway, there you go. Do you want to talk about this movie? Let's get into it. This is,
Let's do it.
It's time to talk about the actual episode.
Let's do it. I'm feeling intellectual.
Oh, good. Yeah.
As I told you already.
You see, you've got your bubble pipe.
Monocle in place.
That's
now.
Right. Let me turn off this Beethoven and we're ready to talk. Videodrome 1983, written and directed by the one and only David Cronenberg. I'm not going to go over his whole resume, but for us in this household, he's
kind of a big deal.
He's kind of a big deal. He's done some of my all-time favorite movies. And it is also composed by his partner in crime, Howard Shore, which I love.
Shore was.
Because as a composer, the one thing I've always picked up on is that there are certain directors that stick with certain composers, like Tim Burton and Danny Elfman, or Angelo Badalamenti and David Lynch, Wes Anderson and Mark Mothersbaugh. Like, there's always these links, and this has always been locked tight as David Cronenberg and Howard Shore. So I was very happy to see the credits start with them. It just sets the tone right away.
And, you know, I actually read a little story about when these two started or decided they were going to work together. David asked Howard, you know, can we
You're
partner?
Not even keeping a straight face in this setup. But go ahead. Let's
Can we
it.
Partner together? And Howard said, sure.
Yeah. No, as the story goes, he said, okay.
Maybe.
So this film's interesting. It opens on a TV channel, like surfing, and it's Civic TV.
It's like, feels like it's the future.
Kind of. It does have an element of future, but all of Cronenberg's stuff has
but
this
it's
kind
also
of
the
like,
it's like an alternate
sci-fi feel.
Alternate future in which technology did not advance.
Yeah, this the beginning of this film took me a while to catch my footing, too. I wasn't quite sure who he was, what was going on, what his role was.
It's not clear.
No, but once I did, I was like, okay, I get it now. But basically, James Wood's name is Max.
Is it
Max.
Wood or Woods?
Woods. James Wood's name is Max in this film, and he's our lead. He's this guy who's like eating pizza and looking at photos of like a couple having sex. And I didn't know what he was. I thought he was a PI at first. I thought he was looking at surveillance photos.
Yeah, there's kind of a sense that he's a PI. And also, when he first gets going, the reason that I thought it was sort of the future was because he gets a wake-up call through his TV. She's like, it's Friday Jones. Don't forget you have a meeting at 9 a.m. So it feels futuristic because it's sort of like a personalized thing, except for it's just the TV.
Yeah, and, you know, that's Cronenberg's films. He's got a few like that aren't, like, so futuristic that they're, like, obvious. They just have these elements of sci-fi. He's always mixed those genres, and so this does a good job of that right away. And it flashes, the opening of this film cuts scenes pretty quick to kind of develop the story really fast, you know?
Yeah.
And it goes to Max at a really shady hotel, and he walks in, and he asks for these movies, and these two Japanese, like, shady businessmen open up a briefcase, and there's a bunch of VHS tapes in there.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is how I imagine you do trades.
This is exactly how I do trade. Actually, it's not that far off with one of my friends. We literally meet in a parking lot at a business to trade VHS because we're, like, busy family people.
Can you imagine if you did this enough and somebody called and was like, these guys keep, like, meeting
doing
for
deals.
5 minutes in a parking
we
lot?
We do have a joke that we're going to get, like, busted, like a sting operation by the cops, because we seriously open up our trunks and exchange goods and then drive off. But he's looking at copies of a film called Samurai Dreams, and this is where we find out it's just a Japanese porno.
Yeah.
And that these weren't surveillance photos. He was looking at images from the...
Like stills.
Yeah,
from
like the
movie.
Porno, and he's discussing how it's kind of soft and he needs something tougher for his audience.
Yeah.
And this is where I'm like, wait, what does he even do?
What's his job? Yes.
But then it shifts really quick again. Also, This was jarring for me, because we on this podcast discuss really cheesy, low budget films most of the time, and this is very artsy fartsy. It's a Cronenberg film. So what I mean is the cinematography is solid, and the transitions are beautiful, and the camera work is really nice. And so even when we're getting from scene to scene, it's got these beautiful, like, sweeping crane shots, and the tracking is really nice on the characters. And I was like, this is just not like, you know, cheerleader camp where it's like really fumbling around with the cinematography, or Alien Space Avenger where he's got pants on one moment and pants off the other. Like, this is a really polished film.
Well, yes and no. What's your thought on films that you don't understand right away, where either through lack of experience or kind of a I'm going to do what I want to do attitude, the director chooses to not make it clear to you what you're doing. Sometimes I feel like there's a purpose for that. In this film, I didn't really feel like there was a reason for us to be left in the dark about what was going on for so long. Like, even at this point, I still wasn't sure what James Woods was doing.
Mm-hmm.
The character Max, what was his job? It still kind of felt like he was an undercover cop, maybe gonna do a sting or something to bust, like, weird underground porno
sales. I thought that too. Yeah.
So it was very unclear. And then once you move forward, you're like, or maybe you weren't. I wondered why that had been made so vague for so long. I mean, it's really just 5 minutes or so, but it was a strange choice.
So here's my thought on it. Unlike one of the cheesy, like, sci-fi films that start, you know, in a world, the world's plagued by mutants, and you go into the film immediately up to date and
with
knowing,
them, like, spelling it out for you.
This feels like meeting a real person, because you have to make a judgment call. You're, like, trying to figure out, you're led into a world that's already happening, and you're just caught up in it. And I liked that it was more kind of realistic, where when you first meet somebody, you're grabbing every kind of little element you can to try and form an opinion of who they are.
Link it to something you understand
and
in your,
like,
own life.
Or imagine
experience.
At a party when you meet somebody, you're listening to everything, and then they'll make some little subtlety that says, like, oh yeah, I fixed this plumbing, and you're like, oh, they're a plumber. And you're putting it together in the moment. And I feel like that's how this film worked, was it was introducing our character, like how you meet a real person. And it didn't really bother me. It was just more like, where am I going with this?
Yeah, I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong with that. I was just kind of curious about your personal preference. I mean, I guess anybody can have a point of view about that.
If it would have kept up like this the whole film, I would have been annoyed, because we have watched films that I feel like they just never anything to make it clear.
That's where you go. They just didn't have a handle on what they were doing at all.
Yeah, but I feel like you said, I bet if we went back and watched this, it's so quick that it's just a brief introduction. And actually, most of the time, the credits are actually rolling over it. So anyway, we find out who he is, which is he meets with a hacker. Actually, we still don't know who he is because
you kind of put it together at this point.
He works at a TV station, and his TV station shows edgy stuff. And one of his...
And it seems to be edgy, but very specifically sexual.
And torturous. It's like sex and violence.
Well, I don't think it was, but he is leaning that way now.
So one of his programmers works with him and says, hey, I hacked into this signal. You got to see what I found. And we get this clip of somebody being, it's like a snuff film of somebody being tortured.
It's really weird. It looks very real.
Very real. And so he gets excited and he's like, this is what I've been looking for. This is what we need to show to be able to stand apart from everybody else. And then that's when we realize, okay, so he's like in charge of this TV station. And it's then solidified when we flash to the next scene where he's on a TV show.
The Rena King show, yes.
Yeah, he's on a show. He's smoking a lot, too, which is hilarious. Very 80s.
Yeah,
he's like smoking a cigarette on
that's
set.
That's one thing that I've noticed since we started this podcast is how prominent smoking was in 80s culture. I don't know that it was in daily life. I don't really remember. But I feel like in film in particular, people are always smoking in hospitals, in cars, everywhere. And now that's unheard of. You would never be exposed to that much cigarette smoke in a day.
Yeah, it's very 80s.
Yeah.
Extremely. And he's being...
Okay, so they're on the...
Yeah, he's being interviewed. He talks about his show being basically sex and violence, which I just wrote a note like, oh, it's a Cronenberg film.
Yeah.
Like, that's his MO. But we meet our second star of the film, which was her very first film role.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because she went on to actually be in a lot of films. But Deborah Harry from Blondie.
Yes.
And she looks awesome.
She's a DJ. She's also being interviewed on the Rena King show. They're being asked about, like, sex and violence in the media. She does a DJ thing where I think she does like therapy.
Yeah, it's like self-help kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And her name's Nikki. That's her character's name.
And he is horrible. He basically just forces himself on her on the air. Verbally.
Yeah,
not,
verbally.
Not physically.
Yeah.
But
he's like, hey, what time am I picking you up kind of thing.
Yes. In a way that now would be like shockingly inappropriate.
Which is funny because right after that, we see him like walking through his film studio, just like slapping his assistant's butts and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was very... but I liked it because this was setting the tone of his character that like this is a sleazebag who just is kind of after his own needs.
Yes.
And this was what was guiding him into, like, pushing him further into the story was he is the type of guy that would do this. He's the type of guy that would want this. And so we'll kind of flash forward, but what we get ultimately is that they end up getting together.
Yes. We should also mention that there is another guest on the show.
Oh,
the
right,
Rena
yeah.
King show.
Professor Oblivion is his name.
And he will only appear in video form. He refuses to appear in person.
So they pull a TV up next to them as though he's like a guest on the show on a TV.
Mm-hmm.
On TV. And that's how he appears. Yeah.
Yes.
So he comes back later. That is important to note.
And then also, so Max has been very interested in this weird snuff film that he first saw a few scenes back. And his hacker guy is like on the job trying to figure out this like origin of these weird snuff films because Max is so instantly intrigued. Anyway, he goes back to his hacker, and this guy says, well, I thought they were coming from Malaysia, but it turns out the broadcasts originate in Pittsburgh.
Right.
So it's an American snuff film.
Yeah.
And they're, like, when we watch it, my automatic thought, you know, maybe it's a 21st century point of view, but was that these are real violence.
Yeah, it's like actual footage.
Yes, but Max's character's under the impression that it's actors.
Yeah, and that it's just really raw and gritty, and he wants to find them so that he can get it programmed onto his TV show.
Yes.
And so Deborah Herrick, her character Nikki, comes over to his house later that night, and they've got some weird kinky like S&M thing. She's very forward with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees that she's got cuts on her that was from another like encounter with somebody, and so she wants to be cut by him or something. And then we get this really, we see a lot of both of them, and he's like poking a needle through her ear and then licking the blood off of it.
Okay, yeah, so it's a sex scene. They watch, but first they watch Videodrome together,
right?
So she sees this violence and is intrigued by it.
Oh yeah, we should back up for our listeners. Videodrome is the name of this show, the snuff show that he's watching.
Yes.
That's what it's called.
The one that he thought was from Malaysia that is from Pittsburgh. So they watch it. And then Debbie Harry is like, Nikki is like, ooh, okay, this is great, I'm into it. And then he pierces her ears while they lay nude on the floor. But it also sort of transitions to where they're on the set of the Videodrome.
Yeah, floor. It's like this weird red room, and yeah, it like morphs into it while this score by Howard Shore is playing, which is really beautiful and creepy, and it's just so well done that this is when I was kind of reminded, like, oh, we're watching a Cronenberg film, we're watching an art house film right now, and it was really beautiful, the transition. It was creepy, it was weird, and it was setting the tone now that we're kind of in for a ride, that this isn't, things aren't what you think they are. They're not as they seem.
Yeah, I agree.
So after that transitional scene and them making out and all that, we go back to the TV station, and yeah, he's still playing grab ass with all his employees. Yes. She's just such a horrible
sexual
character.
Sexual harassment on the job for sure.
But we meet a pretty important character named Masha. Something like that.
Okay.
She's this older lady who's trying to sell him like some standard sexy films.
And oh, yeah. Like, she's like an agent.
Yeah. And he's like, no, this isn't working for me. This isn't tough enough. And
yeah,
he wants Videodrome. And so she's going to ask around.
Yeah. He kind of gives her some incentive to find the origin of Videodrome. And she also suggests that he just make his own.
Yeah, and then after that, the story kind of pushes forward to Nikki being a little weird about saying, like, I'm going to Pittsburgh because
for work.
I'm going to be on Videodrome. I belong on that film. And he gets pretty upset with her, but she's going to go audition. And it's just really weird. There's a funny scene right here, though, I want to talk about, where he's like, you don't know, these people are serious, these people are intense. And she's like, you don't know what I can do. And then to prove it, she takes her cigarette and burns her breast. It's really funny to like prove to him that she can like hang with the tough ones.
Yes.
It is what it is.
Okay.
And then Masha tells
Max, they go out to lunch.
Yeah, that Videodrome agent. She's like, look, dude, this is real. This is an actual snuff film. This is not make believe.
And he's not acting.
He doesn't believe it, but he's now really intrigued. And also, this has nothing to do with anything, but the waiter giving them their order has the craziest hair.
Yes.
Do you remember?
Yeah. Well, it's weird because it kind of focuses on him because, and this is a storyline that goes nowhere and means nothing, but there's like a whole hinted relationship between Masha, this agent, and the waiter, like having a relationship. It's,
well, she just says
strange.
She likes him younger because he says, I'll make it worth your time, we can shower together. And she's like, I'm sure you look beautiful naked, but I like mine younger. And then it flashes to this waiter with really creepy hair,
who is the same age as James Wood, so it didn't really make any sense. But we do learn one other important piece of information, and that's that she says Professor Oblivion is actually behind Videodrome.
Right.
Professor Oblivion being the TV guy that interviewed only from a TV recording.
Yeah, so Max is going to go hunt him down, and he goes into what seems like a homeless shelter or something, but it ends up...
Oh, I thought it was like a strange library.
I couldn't tell what it was, yeah. But it's where Professor Oblivion is, and instead of meeting him, he meets his daughter, who's like the kind of face of the company or whatever, and says, like, my dad's not going to meet you. He doesn't interview for anybody. He hasn't in a long time. But he drops the name, and he's like, well... how about we talk about Videodrome, and walks off, and that gets her really intrigued. So this is what's going to kind of spark the movie going forward.
Oh, can we pause though? Because she says that her father would prefer to like communicate through videotapes. And she actually says the monologue is his preferred form of discourse.
Yeah, I liked that.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I know so many people whose preferred method of discourse is a monologue.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're just like, oh, you're just going to talk. Okay.
Yeah. I actually had a term for one of my previous bosses that... But I won't say it. Anyway, so this moves forward into pure Cronenberg era right now. Like, the film shifts right here into awesome, like pure awesomeness, because Max gets home and he has a gun. He's unwrapping a gun. Did you notice he wraps his gun like a sandwich? It's like in a whole bunch of fabric, like wrapped up into a bundle, like he's swaddling a baby.
Which is weird because we know he has gun holsters.
Yeah, but then he's interrupted in his private moment because the door knocks and a woman who he works with is at the door, and she has something for him, a special delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what it was?
It was a tape from Professor Oblivion.
Oh, yeah. And this is interesting. This is where it shifts.
And also, he slaps her a whole bunch.
Well, she walks in with the tape, and then out of nowhere, he slaps her. But it kind of does this Lynchian thing where she morphs from herself into Nikki back to herself during the slap. And then he apologizes and he's like, I don't know what I just did. I'm sorry I hit you. And she said, you didn't just hit me. And so we realized that maybe he just had like
a hallucination.
A hallucination of some sort. But she leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And as she leaves, he puts on the tape and it's Professor Oblivion talking to him, saying like, thanks for reaching out to me.
Mm-hmm.
But as he's talking, he looks down at his stomach. And it has this, it looks like almost like a scar.
It first looks like a scar. And also right before he put the tape in, it started to like breathe and pulsate like a living thing.
Oh yeah, the tape did itself. Yes. Yeah.
And so this is where things get kind of murky because, so we got this tape moving. He suddenly has a scar and you begin to wonder, what's the scar about? I didn't notice it was there. Also, he's got a gun holster on and no shirt, which was kind of weird. But
yeah, it was cool. Very Bruce Willis, but
whatever.
His stomach starts to split open.
Yes.
And then scene.
On that scar line.
This scene is so freaking cool.
Yes.
This is what David Cronenberg does so well is body horror. The like practical effects that include transformations of some sort. His stomach opens up. And he puts the gun into his stomach.
Yes.
And then pulls his hand out and his stomach closes up. And it's like he was hallucinating, but there's no gun.
And he like pulls the cushions off his couch thinking he had just hallucinated the whole thing. But he cannot find this gun. It has disappeared. It's actually entered the cavity where his... scar was, and now there's not even a scar on his stomach. It's just gone. The gun is gone. And the video from Professor Oblivion says, what's his line? He says, the television screen is the retina of the mind's eye.
Yeah, and then the television itself starts to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see the Atari controllers on top of the TV? That was pretty cool.
Oh, I didn't.
But it starts to breathe, and then Nikki appears.
Yes, but before we get to that, we do get a little insight into Professor Oblivion.
Right, a little backstory.
He says he had a tumor, he began to hallucinate and see visions, and he was the first victim of Videodrome. He accuses Videodrome of creating this tumor that killed him.
Right.
So that's kind of an important point, because then Max becomes very suspicious about what Videodrome is doing.
Yes. And then Nikki appears on the TV and starts calling him. And this is where we get a really, another really cool scene of, like, the TV kind of coming out and stuff like that.
Yes. It, like, pulsates and expands because Nikki's calling him. And she, it like, goes close on her mouth. And then the TV screen expands beyond the borders of the television, so cool. like, frame.
It holds
up.
And
he just buries his face in her mouth. So it's like a, it looks like a balloon kind of, like the TV screen is a weird, like electric balloon pushing itself out of the TV frame. And then he just buries his face in her mouth. It's a really cool visual.
Oh, it's so amazing.
Yeah.
It's awesome. This is weird though. I feel like we should stop and have a little side conversation about this film in general, because we were talking about this last night, is the timing of watching this film seems very current still.
Yes.
With this entertainment, but this violence, and it's such a weird world that Cronenberg has created, where this character is wanting more and more violence to boost his ratings.
Also to satiate his curiosity, to keep him from, like, becoming dulled. Because he's seeing, like, all this porn, and he's become sort of desensitized to it.
Yeah.
So he's looking for something more dramatic, more sensational, something mm-hmm. that pushes the boundaries even further than he's already seen. And it feels very timely. But did you also, in a way, find it kind of reassuring?
Yeah, that we just, it's like things haven't changed.
Like, yeah, that it's human nature. And there's this sense that, okay, so, I don't know, 30 years ago, people were worrying about the effects, the disconnect people get from their TVs.
Yeah.
And now, funny enough, it's not our TVs, now it's our phones, and we're all worried about the disconnect that we're feeling. But I think that being aware of that disconnect or the potential for disconnect is really the key. We all need to be aware of it, but the reality is it's a perpetual problem, whether it's TV or, I don't know, you know, what were they doing in medieval France? Were they, you know, the monks disconnected with their intense concentration on illuminated manuscripts? Who knows?
And they're like, you know, Brother Thomas, quit staring at that illuminated manuscript. Like, no more manuscript time for you. You only get 20 minutes.
Those drawings are becoming way too sexual.
Yeah, you're distracted. You're got to limit your amount of time you're getting to look at that illuminated manuscript.
Yeah, but do you get the sense, though, that there's, like, enough of a distance and time that it kind of reveals a pattern in human nature?
Absolutely. This film felt very contemporary, even though mm-hmm. it was shot in 83. Like, the subject matter resonated still to this day.
Absolutely.
It was very timeless. And so it was just uncomfortable to watch because we knew why the character was pursuing this. And it was so weird and strange, but this compulsion for more and wanting more.
Yeah.
And knowing that you're kind of putting yourselves in harm's way, because what ends up happening is he now knows that something is not good about Videodrome.
For sure.
And he's now starting to, like, full on hallucinate. And at this point now, his stomach opens back up. He sticks his hand in and pulls the gun back out.
Yep.
But the gun then fuses, like Tetsuo style, fuses with his body.
Dude, is Tetsuo 80s?
Yeah, I think Tetsuo is 80s. Body Hammer isn't, but I think Iron Man is. It's right there. We have a poster on the wall. There's probably a date on it. If it is, we should do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's Tetsuo style, like, the hand and the gun fuse together as one, which I thought was really very symbolic, too.
Yeah.
This idea that the violence and the compulsion and the hallucination were all becoming one and the same, and you literally could not separate them from each mm-hmm. other. And now he's got this gun, and he's got this idea.
It's fused, like, through like veins and meat and flesh. It's not like the gun stuck to his hand like glue. It's like the gun has become this organic thing.
Yeah. And he then gets picked up by this guy who says, like, he's running Videodrome. He's the one that's in charge of it. And he wants to talk to Max. So he mm-hmm. puts them in this limousine thing.
Yes, and the guy on the phone is Barry, is his name, which is the most, like, non-threatening name ever. Or perhaps Barry is the most threatening name ever. I can't decide. So he gets a call about Videodrome, gets in a limo, and he goes to a place called Spectangular Optical.
Oh, yeah.
Where he learns, and it's optical as in, like, eyeglasses.
Yeah, they sell eyeglasses.
And he goes inside and he learns that this guy, the owner of Spectangular Optical, also is like trying to sell technology to the government, which is Videodrome. And they've been doing some like tests. And
everybody who's watched Videodrome has gone crazy.
Yes.
Except and for him for some reason.
He wants to record the hallucinations. Apparently they also have technology that allows them to record the hallucinations that Max is having.
Oh, I love this scene. This is where it gets super sci-fi.
Yes. And put like a helmet on him to record it.
The helmet thing that records his hallucinations is so awesome. It's like this weird glowing, like inner lit bubble thing over his head. It is awesome. Like the mm-hmm. imagery would be a amazing cover. I don't know why they didn't use a shot of that as the cover for the VHS, because it was actually, there's a lot of scenes in this movie that would have been a better cover. But
so he puts this thing on his head and he begins to hallucinate. He's whipping Nikki in a TV, but then it changes to the older woman, Masha.
Well,
and then he's suddenly home.
Well, to clarify, when he's whipping her in a TV, she is on a TV and he's whipping the TV. Yeah.
He's actually whipping the back of a TV and so she's acting weird, as though her back has been whipped.
Yeah.
And then the agent, he wakes up again and it's like, it's as though the hallucination is over. He wakes up in his bed and there's somebody under the covers and it's this woman, Masha, that had been trying to sell him porn.
Yeah. And she's like and tied she's and gagged and dead.
Dead.
Yeah. And so he calls over his hacker friend and he's like, there's somebody in the bed. This is when we realize now he's just like, nothing's making sense anymore.
Yeah, it's totally out of control.
Yeah, things are disappearing. They're appearing because when his hacker friend comes over, he's like, there's nothing here. What are you talking about?
Yes. Oh, and the video hacker friend is named Harlan.
Okay, so I have to talk about something real fast because this has been a very intellectually stimulating episode, I have to bring it back down to normal, like, Laser Graves material. What is with James Woods' pants in every movie he's ever been in? He wears them higher than our daughter wears her pants. Oh. Like, do you know what I mean?
Well, maybe he's insecure about his belly button.
So when I saw James Woods was on this, I am not joking. The first thing I thought was, I wonder if he's going to wear his pants really high.
The answer is always yes. Why would you even wonder that?
I first noticed it in Vampires, John Carpenter's Vampires. I was like, why does his pants, why are they so high? Then I started to go backwards in his like filmography and be mm-hmm. like, oh, he just wears his pants really high. And sure enough,
I want to see this submitted in PowerPoint form.
No, I could do a whole lecture Please. On the analyzing James Woods, the height of his pants.
Power pants.
Okay, I'm glad. Call it,
do a PowerPoint power pants.
Okay.
Power pants PowerPoint.
Wearing my pants really high.
James Wood, power pants PowerPoint.
It's Woods.
James's Woods.
Okay. Well, all right. Let's get back to our...
Okay.
Our artsy-fartsy episode.
Okay, yeah. So we have dead Masha in the bed that isn't really there. And then the hacker guy, Harlan, says there has never been a Videodrome. And then he lets Barry in. And Barry wants to know... why Max watched a scum show like Videodrome. So it's just extreme. It's like a, they're just messing with Max at this point.
Yeah. Well, he's a pretty easy target.
I mean, who wouldn't be?
Yeah.
When you hallucinate your face being shoved into a TV and a gun going into your abdomen, all bets are off.
This is weird though, because the next scene is that they shove a tape into his weird stomach cavity.
Also, at this point, Barry reveals that he wants to broadcast Videodrome on Max's channel. So that's why they targeted Max in the first place. They want to, like, make this a national situation. They want to broadcast in an attempt for, like, mind control, I guess.
Yeah, they want to, like, mind control and, like, kill everyone or whatever. But he pulls his gun again out of his stomach and it fuses to his hand. And then he walks into his place of work. So he's got his gun back.
He has to, yeah. He hears Barry's voice saying to kill Max's partners, his business partners. And that's when he retrieves his own gun. And it attaches itself to his body and he shoots his own partners. He, yes, like, goes into the office space and kills everybody. And then he goes to kill Bianca Oblivion. That is the daughter of Professor Oblivion.
Can I say that when he is shooting all of his coworkers, there's a poster on the back I spotted, and it was for a movie called The Evil.
Oh.
Which is cool, because I have it sitting on the shelf right there.
Uh-huh.
But it's this, like, 70s movie. But what I thought was interesting is that The Evil was filmed in Las Vegas, New Mexico, and Vampires, which
we're headed through Las Vegas tomorrow.
Vampires, starring James Woods, was filmed in Las Vegas, New Mexico.
That's all very...
There's a strange connection. I'm sure it was intentional. Would have known in the future, 20 years later.
A side note, when we go through Las Vegas, our daughters think it's the Las Vegas that other people talk about.
It was the first one.
It's not that interesting, though. Yeah. But okay. So he goes to kill Bianca Oblivion, and she says that he's now an assassin for Barry. She tells him basically the entire plot, and that it's his new job to destroy Videodrome.
Yes.
So he goes back to find Barry, and he shoots Barry with a meat handgun, and then Barry dies pretty violently.
Yeah, and the kills, there's just so many amazing effects in this. This whole movie has really good special effects, like practical effects. They look great.
They're gross. And also, at this point, Max is saying things like, "Long live the new flesh."
Yeah.
Which is super creepy when coupled with that.
Yeah.
With these, like, really, like, wet and very, like, I don't know. They just look so lifelike.
So, and it's strange because during all of this, like, it's just gotten totally out of control. They're, like, on an abandoned ship when this is all happening, too. They're, like, at a shipyard.
Yeah, and at this point, they go to an abandoned ship, and he begins to talk to Nikki, who's on TV. We haven't seen her in person since the weird ear piercing.
Yeah, and it's got this kind of Dr. Caligari-like. Do you remember in that film, 89 Caligari, like, where she's on the film, or on the TV talking?
Yeah.
And she's telling him he needs to do, like, total transformation now.
Yes.
It's time for total, which is so Cronenberg.
Yeah, she's saying it's time to totally transform into the new flesh by first letting your body die. And she shows him a video of him killing himself. And then the TV explodes and meat, like, shoots out of the front.
Yeah.
And then he does it. He kills himself with his meat gun.
That's right. Then he offs himself, and that is the film.
Now, is there a part of you that kind of wishes, like, I mean, it's so Cronenberg to have, like, this technology fusing with, like, biological material.
Mm-hmm.
Do you kind of wish that, like, your iPhone was alive?
Kind of.
Like, it could be your pet.
Yeah, kind of.
That also shows you, you know, what you want to buy on Amazon.
I thought throughout this whole film, because I had not seen it before, this would have been maybe part one, but later on, the film that's got Jennifer Jason Leigh and Jude Law that we just watched.
Existence.
Existence. Is this a continuation of that?
They're very similar because we have like meat guns and
it's about altered realities though.
And responding to technology. They're very similar, but also different. Like this one's more about TV content and that's about video game, but it definitely feels like the same world. Yes.
It's like we were just talking about if this was done today, a remake, it would be with cell phones, not with VCRs or whatever. Actually, and technically for my VHS nerd friends out there, I spotted Betamax that he was holding throughout the movies.
Yes, you were very excited.
So I think that I couldn't tell if he was using Beta or VHS exclusively, but it's intermixed. There you go.
You know, now that I'm thinking of it, this and Existence are almost the same movie.
They're very similar. So that's why I thought that this was like a trilogy. You know how filmmakers will do groupings of films where mm-hmm. they say these films go together as one unit? I would not be surprised if he clumps this together with another film.
Yeah, because it's technology, it's the government, it's like mind control. It's basically the same topic.
Yeah.
It's, which is super timely, and kudos to him for exploring it in more than one way.
Yeah. Well, that's the film this week. My thoughts are, I loved it. I think it was a really cool film. I really want to watch it again. I think that I would get it even more now that I know what I'm in for.
Yeah, I feel like you have to watch it once to get the framework, and then you can watch it again to really dig in.
Yeah, but I would recommend it. I'd say you should check it out.
For sure. It's a
must-see. It's kind of a classic kind of sci-fi horror one of the greatest.
You know, we tend to, in our contemporary world, there's a lot of discourse on the role of technology in the way that it shapes our lives and the way we respond to it. But I think that when you consider this was 1983, he was asking some really good questions, making some good points that we've now almost accepted as mainstream. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, you know, so far in the past, that's pretty forward thinking.
Yeah, and I would say one of the things about the film that's not only timely but kind of profound in a way mm-hmm. is that Videodrome causes its viewers to hallucinate stuff that's not really happening. And in today's world, this idea of social media having such a stronghold on people's image of who they are that it almost creates a real-life hallucination where people start to see themselves and see others in ways that doesn't really exist. Like,
yeah.
They start to think that things are ways that they are not, because social media presents the world in a very skewed way.
Yes.
That this is like Videodrome. Like, absolutely. Instagram is like Videodrome. It's really weird.
Actually, I thought a lot about that with Professor Oblivion, because he only would, obviously we learn later that he was dead, but he would only appear in recorded videos of himself. So he got to curate and create an image of himself, and nobody else got to influence that.
Yeah.
It was all his show, even after he died, which was interesting.
It's like the people who hop on Instagram and they're like, hey, I'm just hopping on to say this, but you know that they've done like 12 different takes because the angle and the lighting wasn't right, and they're trying to make it seem really natural. Yeah, this film was like, now that I'm thinking about it, like very forward thinking.
I think it maybe more than being forward thinking is just kind of like pointing out the obvious that human nature is human nature.
Yeah, and given technology, we'll exploit it for the wrong reasons sometimes, too.
I mean, is technology even necessary? It's maybe a tool that we use to express our humanness, but even if that specific technology weren't there, I think we'd still do it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's the episode. If you like what you heard, you can rate, review, subscribe. We're on all kinds of different places. But you can find us on things like Spotify and Podbean and iTunes. And if you want to follow us, we're on Instagram at LaserGraves. Personal sites on Instagram, I'm at Death at 33 RPM.
I'm at Mariah Rose Wimmer.
And tell your friends. We're enjoying having new listeners. Thank you to anybody who is new this week. We hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a weird one. And we'll be back next week with some more 80s stuff. I don't know what we're getting into next week, but
I don't know.
We'll see. We'll probably shift gears from this one.
Nope, we're going to go deeper.
We're doing another Cronenberg film.
Whoa, no thanks.
Okay.
Need a little breath.
All right. All right, bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.